write that down for me, Saito.
Write that down.
Write that. Write that.
With Fumi Saito and Justin Nipper.
Write that. Write that down. Fumi Saito.
Hello, patrons. Welcome back. I'm Justin Nipper, and I'm here with Fumi Saito, and this is Write That Down. And we also have a special guest, run-in appearance from Kiki the Cat. Fumi-san, hello.
Right. Hello from Tokyo.
And hello from Kiki to all of you patrons out there.
Right,
listening.
Right. Oh, so demanding.
Yeah, before we were recording, Kiki was really almost on the mic demanding your attention. But
yeah. Right.
We'll come back to him later. But so today we're going to talk about Keiji Muto once more, part three of Keiji Muto.
Part three of Keiji Muto.
So
how far? Yeah, as far as we can get.
So, okay. Fumi, can you explain to the listeners why this part is important in his career too? Because it's very,
very important.
Different.
Oh, every part of Keiji Muto's 38-year career is important. But this part will directly connect to Japanese wrestling's dark age and also millennium into new century and a lot of the change. See, not just wrestling, but in 1999, 2000, 2001, we all felt this end of 20th century and this bright technology future, all these, future thing on 21st century coming. And at the same time, all 20th century kind of thing will come to an end. Mm. Didn't you feel that?
Y2K scare, Y2K terror.
That too, or all the mystery of 20th century will be solved. Mm. Or what was good during 20th century will eventually come to an end to start the new century or something. And wrestling had the same feeling. Evidently, yeah, that 1999, 2000 is like a more MMA, not invasion, but they were, like Pride or K1 or other things in MMA type of, combat sports was taking over professional wrestling in Japan, sort of. And with this, what I just mentioned, all these mystery will be solved, that all the mystique, I guess, about professional wrestling that we had, as a kid, it's real, it's fake, it's real, fake, and it's like, but you lived with it because you loved wrestling so much that kind of wish it was all real, but at the same time, I'm glad it's entertainment because you have your favorite superstars, but all these things almost never mattered because you always watched wrestling and followed wrestling and you loved it, but this MMA, MMA thing, for instance, Nobuhiko Takada, the superstar of UWF and UWFI, challenging Hickson Gracie of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. He is the biggest, kind of like an alien, invader from other sport, combat sports, Jiu-Jitsu and MMA better than wrestling. And for non-wrestling fans, wrestling has always been fake, like a Santa Claus, Agree? Are you with me?
Yeah. Hickson Gracie and bringing the Gracies to Japan really started to shift this vibe that you were talking about the MMA, about Pride and K1. For like after the Shooto event in 95 with Hickson Gracie and Yoji Anjo got into it in California.
At the California Dojo, and he beat the wrestler, Of all wrestlers, the UWF guys that are supposed to be your toughest and most legitimate professional wrestlers, right? And UWF was a force where they are trying to make professional wrestling into legitimate contest. And we all believed it, which was okay because it was that movement that, it was so huge that, that made Pancras, that Akira Maeda's rings and all these things, it was happening. And but still, wrestling fans were watching.
But there was one weekly pro wrestling magazine cover that I think shocked a lot of people with Anjo's face on it. And his face was really messed up. It was purple and red and bloody.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It looked real.
And they Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, the dojo people actually videotaped it, you know?
That's what I hear. And I hear there is a videotape that Hickson Gracie
owned. Yeah, it's in Japan too, yeah. It showed it at the Shuto Dojo too after that. And it was not professionally taped. It was like home video.
Camcorder, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, but they need, you know, the Gracie Dojo people, you know, needed to videotape it as evidence. Because you might get legitimately sued, or you might be suing each other, right?
Especially so that time, it was more uncertain about what could happen in a fight. So,
yeah, and there was like, we're going to have a closed door dojo fight, and nope, you know, we agreed that you know that it's a fight, but you are not going to sue on any injuries or whatnot, right? So they videotaped it as evidence that the fight took place and this is what happened, and the guy left the dojo, and then they videotaped the whole thing as evidence. But anyhow, that really, you know, hurt wrestling business too. But the interest was, though, the wrestler, you know, in Japan, professional wrestlers are toughest. I mean, entertainer or not, still legitimately tough people doing it, you know. That was the whole concept of it. But one by one, you know, the Hickson Gracie against Takada, Hickson Gracie against Masakatsu Funaki, and other, you know, another Tokyo Dome fight, and rings and K1 Pride things. That Pride, you know, they use professional wrestlers, namely people like Yuji Nagata and Kendo Kashin. You know, the legitimate college wrestling champion turned to be professional wrestling superstar. And Nagata even had an IWGP heavyweight title as a superstar, right? But those are the guys who were sent by Inoki, of all people, sent to those Pride or MMA event. And you remember Nagata having fight against people like a Federer or, you know, Krokop, was just two-day training. Hindsight, it's the craziest, you know, attempt, you know. But Nagata was wild that he just took it. All right, and this weekend I'm going to have a fight. And he just did it, you know. And team player. Huh?
But he was IWGP heavyweight champion at the time he took the fight.
At the time. Oh, think about that. That was so much damage to wrestling business, you know.
I can't imagine. I mean, the only time that was also sort of a similar situation was a couple of years ago when Brock Lesnar and Mark Hunt had that. I think they had a match for the UFC title 5-6 years ago. But it was different because the fans had already kind of learned what MMA was. They're familiar with Brock Lesnar and Mark Hunt and what could happen, and they're more even in skill. They both had experience at a professional level, both. Well,
and also half the people don't even look at Brock Lesnar as WWE wrestler.
Exactly. He had success. He had a lot of success.
One foot on the wrestling and the other foot on the MMA always. But that made him special.
But in Nagata's case, he really, I mean.
Wrestling superstar went in there and with not much, you know, I mean, practice or workout or program or wasn't prepared enough, you know, but he was willing to do so. It wasn't even his, you know, his idea. You know, Inoki just booked him, you know, like through New Japan, and then he didn't, you know, make any noise, you know, okay, I'll do it. Like, team player is a good word to put it, but it was just crazy idea in millennium, you know. I really felt that wrestling business and all the, you know, thing, all the good thing we experienced in the 80s and 90s will come to an end or something. Is this end of wrestling business or what? And I was really scared, you know. Yeah, because is this the end of wrestling as we know it? Oh my gosh, you know, and the timing was the millennium, and you know, you felt that all the good things in 20th century will come to an end once. Then the new century starts or something. It was kind of almost symbolic. And that was year 2000, back to Keiji Muto. There was a reason that he really wanted to leave New Japan. Still under contract with New Japan, though. still under contract with New Japan, but he left the entire year 2000. Spent, where did he go? He went to WCW. Mm-hmm.
Another dying area.
So he witnessed the dying, you know, like Nitro.
The real death of a company. Even more so.
Yeah, the Vince Russo era and Powers That Be, the, you know, all the wrestlers that who, I mean, Sting, the Luger, the Flair, they were under contract, but they were not even around, you know. They stopped coming to Nitro, you know. Mm. Then the Nitro was Booker T and Jeff Jarrett, Sean O'Hara, the, you know what I'm saying? Chuck Palumbo, the, like a very much Vince Russo era. And he really witnessed this place is going to die too, you know. And but he I think at the time Keiji Muto have done everything he could do with New Japan, IWGP title, beating Takada at the Tokyo Dome that was, everybody had this feeling of end of the 20th century into, you know, millennium into, you know, 21st century, something, there's going to be a big change, huh? And yeah, he didn't really go over there or, you know, himself. Keiji took his wife and daughter over and had a new place in Atlanta. And I thought he was going to live there or something. Yeah.
So how long was he there in total? Was he came in 2000 or did he come right in at end of 1999?
I'd say 2000. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he pretty much spent the entire year, you know.
And yeah. By this time, his knees weren't doing that well compared to years prior.
Yeah, but his knees was pretty bad back in 87. You know?
Even so, wow. So he...
Yeah, yeah. So he always worked around it and created the style where he can do certain things in a certain way, you know?
And yeah. We saw more of that after the year 2000 when he finally, was skipping ahead a little bit, but when he did move to All Japan, developed the next stage of Keiji Muto, he altered what he did in the ring.
Yeah, then that's when he was wearing, remember, the black long tights? Mm-hmm. He had this multiple scar, you know, operation and like a foot-long scar, like, you know, tissue and whole thing that he cannot wear that short tights, trunks anymore.
So that's the reason. Oh, I never knew.
Yeah, same way Misawa was wearing the long tights, you know?
Because of
green screen. Long tights. Yeah, like a 2 foot, you know, 2 feet long big scar or something. Wow. You know? And I personally asked Mr. Baba too. He's like, why isn't he wearing short trunks? You know, like, you know, when you're a champion, you want to have, you know, short trunks and ring boots and, you know, like your champion
traditional
wrestler should
look
like,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, yeah. But he has a scar, you know. It's like, you can't show that, you know. I mean, it's okay for some people, but for some people, this foot-long, big surgery scar in both side knees and thighs, and it's just not good. So it's like it's good to cover because you will be taped up too, you know, every time you go there.
Hmm.
Yeah, scar and all white, you know this, you know, athletic taping, mm-hmm. you know, and then you gotta have long tights. Anyhow, yeah, the Great Muta always had the pants, right? So. A regular Great Muto will be having this long ties from that point on. Anyhow, that it was a 2000. And we got to remember, Giant Baba died in January of 1999. Okay? Mm. 1999, January. Giant Baba died. And around the same time, 3 months later, Jumbo Tsurura retired from wrestling mm-hmm. and went to Oregon to be a professor, you know? And a year later, 2000, Jumbo died, you know. And 1 year, Misawa and his group of people, Misawa as a president of All Japan Pro Wrestling, it worked a year, but he put together a plan for pro wrestling Noah, and he was going, you know, Misawa was going to just take a few guys of his guys, and he felt that the New Japan and the Misawa's group was, you know, like a split into two groups. But what happened was every single wrestlers and referees and ring announcer and the ring crew and whole everybody but Kawada and Fuchi left the company, you know, and then came with Misawa, you know, Misawa, and therefore skeleton, you know, all Japan remain, you know, that we have to remember. And year two, at the end of the year 2000, Muto came back. He was trying to figure out, you know, the first match back was Inoki Bombaye, that was half wrestling and half MMA show at the end of the year. Remember?
And it wasn't New Japan. It wasn't All Japan. It was Inoki's independent.
Right. His own. Yeah. I mean, it was Channel 4 money.
Yeah. Big television production.
Big TV production. It's those few years. I mean, after that, all the way to like 2005 or six, at the end of, you know, the New Year's Eve, you always have, you know, it's NHK's big singing festival, Kohaku, right? And then Channel 4, Channel 6, Channel 8, they all had MMA shows.
K1, all night, Pride, long. Everything.
K1, one channel had K1, another channel had Pride, and Channel 4, Nippon TV wanted to have another, you know, MMA show. So they had hired Anthony Inoki as the executive producer and promoter and created Inoki Bomaye. So therefore, then that was a show where wrestlers and MMA fighter both worked. That was like show, 5-6 hour, you know, long show. You have all kinds of matches. And of all things, Muto and Nobuhiko Takada made a tag team, right?
Against Don Fry.
Don Fry and Ken Shamrock.
So it was kind of returning back to that that idea of, you know, are we doing pro wrestling? Are we doing shoot fighting, mixed martial arts?
Oh, then Don Fry and Ken Shamrock is a perfect candidate to sort of to be deceiving.
Exactly. In a way. Yeah. To be the best.
You know what I'm saying?
Especially then.
Yeah.
And throw Takada.
Yeah. Yeah. And Nobuhiko Takada. Yeah. Keiji Muto, obviously, just wrestling superstar. But if he wanted to be, he probably could have been big MMA fighter too, you know?
Sure.
But Keiji Muto's, you know, philosophy was like, what's the point, right?
Yeah, I could see him and also later Satoshi Kojima, they never used or incorporated any of the combat sports or mixed martial arts style into what they did. They never did. They did it more traditional.
Yeah, but what he was so good at in dojo was like the quickest kimura he can put on anybody.
Really? And he was a judo. He had a judo background going in.
Yeah, judo, like a third in national. Yeah.
So he was special. He's kind of a star from way before.
And also, yeah, before New Japan Wrestling, he got the chiropractor license. He knows people's bone and muscles and tissues and joints. Mm.
So there, it seems like there was a lot of thought going into his next move, his next choice.
Right. And year 2000 ended. So he came home, right? Mm-hmm. 2001 starts. Mrs. Baba, after, you know, Misawa's group left and they formed a new group, Pro Wrestling Noah, to be the next big major league professional wrestling fan, but that Mrs. Baba, that's when she pretty much decided that she is not going to give up. You know, if it was all Misawa's, you know, group, in harmony, and kept the old Japan, and it was Jumbo Tsura before he left, he asked Mrs. Baba to have Misawa to be the next president. You know, Mrs. Baba wanted Momota to be the president.
Oh, you know? The grandson of Riki Dozan?
Yeah, no, son of Riki Dozan.
Mitsuo Momota was...
Yeah, son of Riki Dozan.
His grandson is also wrestling now?
Chikara.
That's okay. So Mitsuo Momota was possibly going to be president or in charge after Baba died. That's who...
Yeah, and the All Japan Pro Wrestling. It was Mrs. Baba's choice.
Mrs. Baba's choice. She wanted that.
Yeah.
Jumbo Tsuda wanted Mitsuharu Misawa to be.
Misawa, coach. Yeah.
So that was a.
But the Misawa Jumbo Tsuda was leaving because he, with his master's degree, and he was going to take the special professor position in Oregon, and he was leaving wrestling completely. That's when Stan Hansen decided to retire. It was a brand new era, you know? And Misawa's people stayed with Old Japan with Mrs. Baba, but only lasted a year, you know, that I don't know how to put it without being kind of harsh about it, but I want to be nice about it, though, okay? But let's put it this way. The king died, right? The king.
Baba.
But everybody in the kingdom secretly hated the queen. Therefore, under the queen, that things weren't the same. And Misawa eventually, even being the president, eventually was going to leave and form his own company, wrestling. And it's just leaving like a Baba family, you know. And it was going to be just Misawa and his guys. But it ended up being almost every single wrestler, every single ring announcer and, you know, ring crew and referee and front office employee, almost everybody. But Kawada and Fuchi, you know. But Mrs. Baba decided to, you know, keep the company. And you have Fuchi and you have Kawada, and she hired all kinds of freelance wrestlers from all over the country and ended up signing Tenru, too, for the first time in 10 years.
He returned.
Tenru came back. Yeah, yeah. Then that was the year Muto still being under contract with New Japan, that the he was sent to All Japan to work, All Japan dates.
Like a dream match kind of situation. Like he was on loan.
Because the group of, not everybody, but the group, you know, people, the executive from New Japan wanted to purchase that version of All Japan.
In 2001?
Yeah.
So this version you're talking about is the one with Keiji Muto and...
No, not yet. Not yet.
So right before that.
Keiji Muto will not be president or under contract of All Japan until January of 2002.
Okay, so we have about a year to go.
Yeah, during 2001, group of executives from New Japan wanted to purchase All Japan, you know, Mrs. Baba's version of All Japan Pro Wrestling, much like Vince McMahon purchasing dying WCW. Does that make
around
sense?
The same time too, actually.
Around the same time. That's why it's so scary.
Yeah, crazy.
Like a new, brand new era and a new century. All the 20th century type good thing will come to an end. I mean, if you were there, you know, you really felt
big
it,
changes, you know? Felt like they were coming.
Yeah,
the internet was a thing now, and it was part of what was going on with wrestling. Not too much.
Yeah, you had internet, you know, and then people had my computer was Windows Millennium or 98,
XP or yeah,
something like that. Yeah, yeah, changed a few times since then, but internet and the emails, you know, turn into an everyday thing, but not as much. Mm-hmm. No moving picture like, you know, today's, you know, streaming service movies.
Yeah, no New Japan World, like no YouTube.
No YouTube, no WWE Network, nothing, you know. But so rather the news and information travel a little, you know, slower.
Yes. And
but during 2001, Muto worked, still under contracts with New Japan, but worked all the big shows for All Japan Pro Wrestling. Mm-hmm. Muto against Tenryu, Muto against Kawada, you know. At the time, those were dream matches that worked, you know.
They had to do those. They had.
Yeah, they were still running Budokans a few times a year. And and during the course of 2001, Muto really felt that this might be what he wants to do, you know, that he had this close to 20-year career with New Japan and American careers, you know, great Muta. Now that he changed the looks, he shaved his head, it was in Stone Cold, you know, the Kurt Angle, you know, yeah, great Muta, you know, Keiji Muto, all had the bald, you know, shaved head at the time. It was symbolic too, actually. He really felt like leaving New Japan for good. Then it was Hiroshi Hase who put together an idea of taking over the company. At the same time, just like I said a few minutes ago, group of people, actually, to be exact, like his name was Nagashima from New Japan. They were executive. They wanted to purchase that skeleton version of Mrs. Baba, Motoko Baba's Old Japan, like much like your WCW purchase by Vince McMahon, and to be the New Japan brand of All Japan Pro Wrestling, owning two different company under the same umbrella. That was the idea. But it wasn't like for everybody. It was, Muto thought it would not change anything. That just become under same New Japan umbrella, you know? And no, he wanted to make this Old Japan real separate from New Japan cluster or something. And Hiroshi Hase and Muto put together plans, and he really wanted to divide this to a different company. And he really completely left New Japan since.
And he never, I mean, he's returned in guest appearances, but he has been on his own path since then, pretty much, past 20 years.
Yeah, since then. Yeah. So it's like, this is the same. I mean, this is All Japan Pro Wrestling. See, coming from New Japan School of Wrestling, All Japan is like so far away, because they never mingled, you know, really. Different philosophy, different channel. It's almost different genre.
It's like Marvel and Misawa. DC Comics. Two different universes.
Oh, but yeah, I guess so. Yeah. For non-wrestling fans, they're all the same. But for anybody who know anything at all about wrestling, it's like American League and National League. Or, like you just said, you know, Marvel comic and DC comic. Mm. It looks similar, but it's a two different thing, and it tasted different. They promote and present differently. And it was, after all, Inoki type of professional wrestling and Baba style professional wrestling, you know, Jumbo Tsura type of professional wrestling to Fujinami Choshu style professional wrestling. They were so different. But Muto actually is on his own league. Huh?
He's in the kind of mixed stage. He went away and learned a lot more from the world and came back and, I think, added a lot of different elements to what we see in current Japanese wrestling.
Yeah, because he made, you know, not just one trip. Remember, he had 1985, 1986, 1987 trip to Florida to be the Black Ninja.
Mm-hmm.
He spent a year there. Then came back to New Japan as a Space Lone Wolf and spent another year or so, you know, almost mid-card babyface. But at the time, there was a New Japan group. Within the New Japan, there was a New Japan Seikigun, UWF group, Riki Choshu's group, an American group. You have like 50, 60 guys in the dressing room, and Sakaguchi decided to send Muto back to America, right? And then that's the time he went to Puerto Rico and Dallas and signed with Crockett, and Crockett became WCW, and he was great Muta. Working Starcade against people like Flair and Sting and Luger, and then he became star. So two big trips. Then the 2000, he spent another year in America witnessing dying days of, you know, WCW and WCW Nitro, all the political, you know, scene that he witnessed, more so than the actual wrestling. But that's when he decided to be more of a producer type.
Yeah, because he had such a unique international view of what wrestling is or what wrestling could be. He was, and different eras too. I mean, he was wrestling in the States in a certain time period when wrestling was one way. When wrestling was, what it was in 1989 was so much different than what it was in 1999, 2000, night and day.
Right.
He saw both. He was there for
no
both.
Monday night thing.
Yeah,
man.
No Monday night thing. No, not as much TV, different budgets. And at that, in the late 90s, of course, we all know that that's when there was a little wrestling boom in the States. More people were watching.
Yes, because what Muto witnessed during the year 2000 was like, every week, every Monday, they go to certain cities, 100 wrestlers in the dressing, you know, in the backs, you know, backstage, taping the skit, you know?
So he must have had such a different idea or perspective than his co-workers and colleagues in Japan at the time, because I mean, Japan was going through its own, the wrestling industry was going through its own growing pains and growing out in between. And we mentioned Noah, we mentioned.
And the MMA invasion.
MMA, but yeah. There was also 01. There were a lot of other, like Choshu did his thing too. So everything was really splintered.
No, that's like a 2002, 2003. Yeah,
right? We're heading Muto's, towards that era.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
things were falling apart. So
New Japan is breaking up to several groups too. Hashimoto's 01. Riki Choshu again with Double J in the World Japan Pro Wrestling. New Japan, as we knew it, it really broke into three or four pieces too.
Yeah. And it didn't have the impact it had like it had in the 90s because there was no number one star. People were still looking at Inoki, I think, as the main guy or and somebody.
Inoki
like that.
Retired in 98, but remained in public guys forever.
Oh, he was on all the time.
That is very. And that almost killed the business too, because people think Inoki is a bigger star than the current superstars, right? Always will be, but he's not working in the ring. And that would hurt the actual business.
And it seemed to, and like we said at the beginning of the show, we're talking about Yuji Nagata and Kendo Kushin. They were his sacrifices from wrestling. To-
yeah, because Anthony Inoki decided to side with MMA world instead of wrestling.
He sacrificed them to MMA. And
because the Inoki's philosophy was, I don't know about other people, but my wrestling was real in my days. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, but there was no Fedor in your days either, Mr. Inoki.
Yeah, but Mr. Inoki had actual legitimate fight against Muhammad Ali.
Possibly the first MMA fight.
Yeah, yeah. Now hindsight, people go back to that as a root of MMA, So that's a lot of research to be made, and you can study Inoki Ali fight forever.
There's a whole book that was written on it in English.
Yeah, but books have been written over here in Japan too. Not just one, but quite a few.
So it's a big, to Inoki, it was a big idea, philosophy. Like if you can't fight like I did, then,
Yeah, because that's how he became, equal to Baba. When Inoki and Baba were together, Giant Baba number one and Inoki clearly number two person. Then they went a separate way. That to be able to be the number one guy or even above Giant Baba, Inoki had to come up with a lot of ideas. See, Giant Baba's Old Japan always had every single American superstars like your Funks, the Jack Briscoe, the Harley Race, the Nick Bakwinkle, AWA, NWA, everybody.
All
much.
The top so NWA, you know, AWA superstars.
Yeah,
top at the
time,
for sure.
At the time. And they rotate and all through the year, tour after tour after tour, all the big superstars you read on magazines, they come to Baba's. Whereas Inoki had Taiga Shichi Singh, that's why Inoki had to go through this MMA, like Inoki against Muhammad Ali, Inoki against Chuck Wepner, Inoki against this and that, Ruska. William Ruska.
No, there was another karate guy, Willie Williamson.
Willie Williams. Yeah.
So
Kyokushin karate guy.
What did they call? They called them other. What? There's a name for those kind of matches, like special matches or other, like a special. It's like a special.
Ishikaktogi. Ishikaktogi.
Like special.
Translated mixed martial arts.
Okay, yeah, like a mixed combat sports or thing.
Yeah.
Event.
But that became the term MMA decades later, though. That's interesting.
Yeah, they were developing kind of at the same time in the English speaking circles and in Japan between wrestling and the combat sports. But and Muto was watching all of this.
Ishii, as a kid, but Muto was the one who when he was rookie, he told Akira Maeda, UWF at the time, like in 86, he was like, nobody's digging your shit. It's so honest. It's like nobody's having a good time watching your shit. It's like no fun.
Oh, I read something, a translated kind of blurb that he said when he was comparing himself to the UWF guys. If you think if the UWF group is taking all the shoot and mixed martial arts elements from Sayama that Satoru Sayama used, kickboxing techniques and quote unquote real techniques, where Keiji Muto left all of that out and went to Sayama and took all the flashy stuff. And I think what he said was he didn't want to wrestle in a way that ignored the audience. And he felt that this realistic style, while it's realistic, it doesn't entertain. And I think he learned how to entertain.
Right. He felt it's so boring.
Because he had that background from the States of how to be an entertainer.
From judo?
Judo and how to entertain, just how to entertain people watching you with this pro wrestling idea. Not trying to ignore what they're doing and focusing. I mean, that's a flavor of pro wrestling, I suppose, is when it's...
Yeah. And also Muto, in his own mind, that he can entertain because he's very gifted and talented. And he doesn't really, you know, just him, not the whole group of or whole his generation of people. Muto himself individually can handle anything.
I think his partner always wasn't always, it wasn't just the person or people in the ring, but he's so dependent on how the crowd reacted to him and how the crowd reacted to what was going on. He would really base what he did, especially in All Japan, where he did less and less stuff. He did less movement, but he had great matches still in just different ways.
Yeah. So he felt that I asked, you know, I had an interview with him around the same time too, that the whole motivation was that he didn't feel that he was needed, you know, in New Japan circle. And while he was working All Japan big shows during the year 2000, he really felt that these people needed me.
Because they had nothing at the point, because everyone had left, right?
Yeah, so it's like it feels so much better to be needed and wanted and welcomed, and that I've got to go to that ring. And it's like, oh, wow, there's nothing he could do anything anymore with New Japan Group, you know? So he really was leaning towards working All Japan. And at the same time, his old friend, politician Hiroshi Hase, put together all the details and brought to Mrs. Baba, and Mrs. Baba said great, you know, it's, you know, he's coming, and it's just really, really leaving. See, New Japan always try to trick you, so she didn't trust the idea first, you know, but they gave, you know, had a real, this like a closed door meeting, that is this for real? Is Muto really leaving New Japan and really come to All Japan? Then if Muto comes in and do this and be a president, Mrs. Baba is already leave. Leave wrestling for good. Because Mrs. Baba was never wrestling people. Mrs. Baba was never wrestling fan. He was Mrs. Baba. That's why she spent 30 years doing it, you know, but now Baba's gone but she didn't want to, you know, just leave All Japan as it is. But now that somebody like Keiji Muto really leaving New Japan and be part of All Japan, and he's taking a company over, that she's ready to retire, you know? That's what happened in January of 2002.
So, okay, so we're right around the time where 2001 is over. Keiji Muto has made the jump. And I think late in 2001, that's when he won the Triple Crown for the first time too.
Right. But it's still under
New Japan banner.
I mean, technically under contract with New Japan, working big show, All Japan's big show. So winning a title, no problem, you know. But that's like, there are only few people who had both IWGP Championship and Triple Crown Championship at the time.
It was big news.
Probably, Tenryu and Vader, that's about it,
I think,
right?
So.
Yeah. And also people were excited that the Muto coming in, that would create all kinds of dream matches, you know. And upon his arrival, he took Satoshi Kojima and Kendo Kashin from New Japan. And those three will make a lot of, you know, dream match come true.
And those two that you mentioned, Kojima and Kendo Kashin.
Very popular.
Very popular. And they had a completely different career from this point too. I mean, I don't know if it would have been the same if they stayed in New Japan at that time.
Satoshi Kojima, after another 10 years later, that he will come, eventually go back to New Japan, you know, to be with Tenzan's tag team partner and all that. But Kendo Kashin never went back to New Japan. He had his own path, you know? Yeah.
He's a very unique character too.
Unique character, yeah. And then this event really changed people's fate, don't you think?
I think so. I think a lot of people, especially on the All Japan, let's say the Motoko Baba All Japan version from 2001, 2002, and on. So 2002, Keiji Muto, he had signed on. He was with All Japan Pro Wrestling. In the meantime, Pro Wrestling Noah was basically the old incarnation of All Japan.
Oh, Baba's vision.
And it was doing really well. They had their own.
What was not calculated at the time was, though, Channel 4, Nippon TV, went with Pro Wrestling Noah instead.
So that was the big, what is it?
Yeah, so Muto's version of All Japan did not have television.
Yeah, they lost they've been on NTV since.
I mean, network television, I'm talking.
Yeah. So, and All Japan had been on that channel for decades at that point.
It'd
be like New Japan.
At least 30 years up, before that.
Yeah, it'd be like New Japan leaving TV Asahi. It'd be pretty big deal.
Yeah. Not just exposure, but the budget they pay you annually, you know?
So things were really, really different. And the shows that they were running in All Japan at the time, 2002, if you check out All Japan TV or YouTube, you can see it looks different. There's smaller venues, very dark venues. And Keiji Muto is wrestling guys that you would never think.
Because it's a philosophy is different. And the way they run company office, you know, front office different. See, not just Muto himself. I just said Muto and Kojima and Kendo Kashin as wrestlers, right? But actually, they took 5 or 6 New Japan company employees, you know, like your front office staff, like a salesperson and a PR person with him. They all migrated, like 5 or 6 guys migrated to All Japan office, you know. But what we didn't know then was, though, they didn't really grow up as All Japan fans.
So they
grew up as New Japan fans. So they were watching, you know, old video at the office, you know, and they were watching old tape of Terry Funk or the Mill Maskers or some, you know, like old tape. They're sitting in the office watching, right? Oh, I didn't know Terry Funk was that popular. Wow, Mill Maskers was this popular? It's like, they didn't even watch TV growing up. They grew up watching Inoki in New Japan, right? Mm. So they came in All Japan office, didn't realize that they knew so little about All Japan's history.
And this,
the way they ran office, the way the history, Terry Funk, Mill Maskers, I never knew they were that popular. Oh my gosh. And they and an older All Japan employee, you know, the staff were looking at each other and said, wow.
They must have had fierce loyalty to New Japan during that time.
Because New Japan fans only watch New Japan and Inoki was the greatest thing. And All Japan fans thought Baba and All Japan was the real traditional professional wrestling, you know. And Inoki's always a little bit more original, right?
Yeah, he has his own style, and it's less connected to what's happening in the world. Like I always thought, what I mean by that is, but All Japan was always kind of like on the same level. It tried to stay in with all the storylines that was NWA was holding at the time. It was kind of like, you know, the Japanese arm of the NWA. It was kind of officially recognized. So I think a lot of people liked that. Not only was it a part of the big game, like the wrestling Olympics or something you could think of it as, but also all the best Japanese wrestlers were, you know, on par. They were as good as the best American or English wrestlers.
Yeah.
That's how it was presented.
Yeah. And also all these, you know, dream match when I was a kid, you know, superstar against superstar dream match, you know, would be held, you know, you can watch that happens in All Japan ring and you expect double count out or double DQ. And it's always like that.
So common.
Whereas Anthony Inoki would beat everybody.
That's right. He didn't lose for about 7 years. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And also it was like Japanese babyface against Japanese heels. Right.
That's right. And All Japan had more foreigner
American
versus
Yeah, and then Jumbo to the Japanese big baby face. And turning Tenryu Japanese heel was a big, big new formula. Yeah, yeah. So this is different, all different school. And anyhow, that the Muto's people came in and they started running All Japan's, you know. But what they didn't calculate was that they knew they were going to lose the TV deal, you know. And yeah.
So,
it was part of the Dark Age too, you know?
Yeah, and Dark Age is an appropriate term because if you, like I said earlier, if you do watch some of these shows, there was no light. They're so dark and dingy, and there weren't as many people as we're used to. I mean, only a couple of years ago, All Japan was at the Budokan, and I was watching a few matches over the week preparing for this, and he was having matches with, you know, you wouldn't think, he was having matches with George Hines, you know, Jackie Fulton, and he's having matches with Bart Gunn, and... guys, yeah. Wrestlers that you wouldn't assume that you might see him wrestle
the top talent.
Yeah. Or you might see him wrestle these guys in WCW, but
yeah,
it was
yeah.
different. So I think a lot of people and myself,
American wrestlers in Japanese market, but they did bring in people like, you know, Rosie and, it wasn't called Umaga, but the, you know, yeah. Yeah. And Jamal. Yeah. Right.
Dr. Death, Steve Williams was there, but,
yeah, right. But he was getting sick then, though. Already.
Having short matches.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, they brought in Goldberg. They went to borrow some money from Mrs. Baba again and to bring in people like Goldberg, you know? But Goldberg wasn't a solution, you know? I mean, like, he's like almost retired, you know, right between WCW and WWE. You know, Goldberg was freelancing and... they spent a ridiculous amount of money to bring him in, you know, like $100,000 a match or something, and you know, but that didn't really help, you know, all that much.
Yeah, because there was also so much more going on than before. It wasn't just All Japan and New Japan. By 2002 and into 2003, we started getting more options.
Muto came up with the formula that Muto's All Japan against Hashimoto's 0-1. Mm-hmm. Company against company program.
So who was in 0-1 when they started out at the time with 2003 with Hashimoto's
Hashimoto?
Mm-hmm. So he took a few guys too with him from New
Japan. Yeah, Shinjiro Otani, Tatsuhito Takaiwa, and Takaiwa and Shinjiro Otani, and quite a few independent freelancers, and also Fujiwara was working, you know, dates at the time, you know. And somebody like, you know, Takayama will take, you know, pick up a date. Somebody like Minoru Suzuki will work a date or two, you know.
And they also had access
very
to
Japanese oriented
NWA title too, the old NWA belt.
Oh, right. Now Naoya Ogawa and the New Jersey version of NWA,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. But the same belt. So some people liked it, you know. Some people denied it. Mm-hmm. And, oh God, it's just, isn't that this millennium mess?
It was very, and for me, I was younger and it was hard to follow because there wasn't all that much coverage. I mean, there was coverage of it.
And it didn't look like it was all for the greater good or something.
It looked like a lot of popular wrestlers wanted to have their own, they didn't want to lose control.
Yeah, and then ended up being counterproductive almost, you know. How many wrestling companies are there, you know? And and Riki Choshu leaving New Japan and created Double J World Japan Pro Wrestling just for a year and took Kensuke Sasaki and Hiroshi has to work date there. Kenzo, you know,
Kenzo Suzuki,
and from All Japan, they took Omori, Takao Omori, and they put together a little group. And also, the main event was Riki Choshu against aged Tenryu, you know, and the booker Masa Saito. It's like, how many groups did New Japan had split into, you know?
It was hard for fans to follow, I think, and they were forced to choose.
And at the same time, you are watching K1 and Pride.
Yeah, and that was what was the popular stuff.
And they are stealing the popularity, you know, because basically, I don't believe there was K1 fans. I don't believe there was MMA or Pride fans. Wrestling fans moved into that, you know? And some of the wrestling fans never came back.
Yeah, there were so many people.
Because they found the answer. They found the answer. They always wished wrestling was real for them. It wasn't real for them anymore. Oh, it's always real for me. To this day, I love wrestling the best, you know? I mean, I think you feel the same way, you know? We were never MMA fan. But when wrestler worked MMA show, you had to watch it, you know?
Yeah, because there were a lot of people that came that didn't ever like wrestling that came and began going to K1 shows and going to Pride shows and talking about it. And it was almost like a trend for a little while.
Yeah,
among people that just... Yeah. You know, would never even bring up pro wrestling in their life. Like, you know, they remember Pride or they remember K1 on TV for some reason. It was that big. It was that culturally.
It was more like your Las Vegas feeling, right?
Yeah. Or like, I don't know, Super Bowl.
Michael Buffer type. Yeah.
Like, or like a big boxing fight. Like in the
90s. Something like that. That's why I said very Las Vegas.
Vegas. Yeah. Very Atlantic City kind of just one night of enjoyment.
And in fact, they brought in people like Michael Buffer just to say, let's ready get ready to rumble.
Yeah. Probably paid him a lot of money too.
You know, yeah, and it's all like a very television, you know, attitude, you know.
And speaking of television attitude, this was also around the time, I think within this year or the next, is when WWE really kind of planted their foot down in Japan through TV.
Oh, it was partially because of Sky Perfect TV, mm-hmm. That the new satellite channel is 200 different channels. The satellite dish, you put it up in your... Did you, when you lived in Japan, did you have that satellite dish up in your, you know, balcony or...
No, I would have to have bought it. I had the kind of TV that was...
I mean, just to get for American audience, all the listeners out there to understand, in Japan, satellite dish to put it in outside your apartment and to receive your satellite channel dish.
It's the only way you can watch a lot of pro wrestling, actually, because like we were saying, like the Inoki's show was on NTV and TV Asahi shows New Japan. All of those big channels that we talked about, like Fuji TV, they're on. Yeah. It's kind of like everybody has those channels. If you have a TV,
network channels.
So
right.
That's kind of different from, say, the States, where like states have regulations and they're federal regulations, and you can't just.
Yeah, over here too, the zoning law. That's why Japan was never big on cable. You know,
yeah, and I think
the cable, you have to actually have this cable hooked into your building. The way, you know, Japanese houses are built in a small neighborhood and smaller alleys and all the telephone poles and all this cable, actual cable is like impossible in Tokyo.
Yeah, and if you live in Tokyo, you can easily just go 15, 20, 30 minutes on the train and go to the venue and check out the show for.
Yeah, I guess. Right. But this satellite dish with Sky Perfect TVs, 200, 300 different channel came in, and people bought it for movie channels and, you know, your MTV or your all kinds of sports channel. And one of them, J Sports, had all the WWE program already in it with Japanese subtitles, like movies, you know. They had not just Monday Night Raw, you know, Monday Night Raw, but you had your new program, SmackDown. That was new at the time, mm-hmm. right? And they had that. What's the third show, like Saturday Night Shotgun?
That time, it was Velocity or Jacked or Heat.
Velocity, yeah.
Sunday Night Heat. What's the other one? Sunday Night Heat.
Yeah.
And, Jacked.
Right. What's the other one? The Taka Michinoku and Funaki was always on.
Oh, Velocity?
Velocity, yeah. It wasn't even popular then.
It was on at 2 in the morning on select channels when I was a kid.
Okay. But that gained a new audience. What they were watching, they never knew Monday Night Raw was such that the backstage skit, storyline, diva, Vince McMahon's own, you know, involvement with all the dramas, family drama, Stephanie, that the Undertaker being evil, the Stone Cold, Rock, that era, that got really new audience, like a TV viewer. Then they brought in your live event to Yokohama Arena, you know?
It was almost like an imported live event, like the circus.
Yeah, like a rock concert. They brought in a Rocky Horror Show or something.
I even see pictures when WWE comes to Japan, you see all the fans in the cosplay. They
cosplay, of like course.
So many. So it has its own.
So many of them.
It's,
so they are they wrestling fans? Yes, but they are WWE fans. They created the whole new crowd, whole new audience. Yeah.
And that on top of all of the new Japanese companies in 2003, 2004.
Oh my gosh. You know, yeah. It's, if wrestling was popular, yeah, it's like so much, you know, so many wrestling groups to choose from and you should be happy. But I had this gut feeling that something's gonna, you know, break.
Yeah.
You
know? So, I mean, yeah. So this was kind of lasting for a little while. He was, it's 2004, 2003. Muto had established his All Japan.
So it, today we're talking about, you know, Keiji Muto and his version of All Japan. They really struggled, but they, you know, they had to do what they had to do. You know, this is All Japan. This is Keiji Muto running a company and still being top star. And you're running one, you know, the whole year schedule. You know, you have your spring tour. You still have Champion Carnival. You still have to carry your Triple Crown title. You have to have some Americans. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And they eventually, within these few years, they did get on that satellite channel, Gaora.
Gaora,
but it's much smaller.
Gaora is not all that. Oh God, it's, they would not pay you the fee, like annual fee. Other network channel will, you know, pay you.
It's kind of like, if patrons are listening now, it's like MLW on Fubi, Fubo Sports or whatever it's called. I mean, it's big, okay. It's, you know, it's got money. It's big, but it's not NBC. It's not USA. It's not TNT. Like, not even close. So it's much different in All Japan at this time now too.
We have to remind our listeners that there is no moving picture in internet at the time.
Right. It's not like we can just hop on the internet. I mean, what I would do, I mean, I had we had cable internet by this time or in the 2000s, but if you wanted to see it, you have to maybe wait at least a month and a half to get the tape.
Yeah.
I mean, I would trade tapes with certain people, or you could buy TV, but the TV shows would be third or fourth generation. They would be so deviated by the time they got to America. Yeah. So
not just wrestling, but a lot of change, like a drastic change in the media that the
life changes.
Yeah. So we went through that at the time. Yeah.
And Muto was kind of living out the changes in front of us. He had the shaved head and the goatee and the new style.
Yeah, and he was just every bit just as good, but the time wasn't the greatest, mm-mm, right?
So that's why I think we saw him popping up again and again sometimes in these dream match situations. Like, I remember he showed up in
At the time, because while he was being the president of all, you know, his version of All Japan Pro Wrestling, and you know, president, top star, a booker, yet he was taking dates from people like Hustle shows. Remember?
Oh yeah, that's the really dark. Yeah. That's how dark it got.
Oh, that's Hustle. Oh god, that's dark.
Hustle is the darkest of the dark ages.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Oh, I just can't. I mean,
how can, if we had to,
I tried to erase it from my head.
if you had to explain, so some people don't know what it is, but Hustle was a pro wrestling
Hustle
company, kind of ran by Pride's Dream Stage Entertainment.
Yeah.
So if you had to explain it in one sentence,
and they were calling themselves not a professional wrestling, but fighting opera or something
crazy. Yeah. How could you describe it to somebody if you could only use one sentence to describe it?
Wrestling run by non-wrestling people, no at all people.
They didn't have any either background or further interest in it. It was just really random.
Or just it's worse. Mm. Worse, because they thought they knew wrestling, how to make, you know, like people come and pay for it. And they thought they studied the WWE and they learned about how to do storylines. And with Pride, they had money, some kind of money to play around. They were able to bring in people like Goldberg, Nash, Hall, Cactus Jack, Mick Foley, and Steiner Brothers, on top of your, at the time, very big Japanese, you know, big in Japan superstar like Bob Sapp.
Or even Japanese stars like Hashimoto and Naoyagawa.
Right. Yeah, it's sad enough that they were hurting. So they would take booking from Hustle. They would probably pay you per match better than your own company. something wrong with it, right? With
yeah, it was hard to, and even Kawada would show up and he would be doing comedy.
Kawada would show up as a Dangerous K, yeah.
Do the dance, and yeah. Takada had the M. Bison.
Yes, it's so it's like somebody's selling their soul.
It felt like oh, what's happening? God. What happened?
In this world.
Yeah, yeah, and especially with somebody like Takada, who was the top of the serious game.
Would hit Lacoste? Yeah. Oh my gosh.
And you had Mark Colbin and Kevin Randleman, who were...
Right, yeah, people like that, the legitimate MMA fighter pretending to be wrestler.
Bad.
I just... All those bad things. Oh God!
It was.
I'm trying.
Yeah, you're trying. You. It sounds like you still have a PTSD over it.
Oh yeah, I do. I do.
I think many people do. We'll have to sometime revisit some of these shows because I don't even. I think I need some help understanding.
That's how I got sick. I think.
Hustle.
Yeah, well, around the time and what was happening in the wrestling world, and I thought it was this is going to be the end of professional wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, 2000
year 2007, my God, oh, you know, yeah. Carl Gotch died, you know, and my friend Mike Awesome died, Bam Bam Bigelow died, and Chris Benoit thing happened.
It was a bad time. It just and from 2005
to that. Yeah, and then I went to the doctor and they told me I had cancer.
dark ages.
That was the same year. Yeah. So I had a major operation. I removed the entire stomach and yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, it was a bad period.
But we made it out. We all made it out. Muto and all.
I think so. Oh, great. Great.
Because
yeah. Yeah.
So, okay. So let's talk a little bit about 2005, 2007 ish. So it was nothing more happened.
Wrestling survived.
It survived. Yeah. It wasn't like 2000 where it was like an earthquake. It was, everything was shifting. You know, the world was Pangea was breaking apart into.
And also, yeah, we were all, you know, ready to close 20th century, new millennium, and the bright 21st century was going to happen, right?
But not immediately.
Not immediately.
So,
oh boy.
So, but around this time is also when Keiji Muto again pulled out and started his own project again, Wrestle One.
Yeah, that Wrestle One was like another hustle done by K1, though.
Right, which is why it's
Hustle was K1. Run by Pride people, right? Wrestle One was another wrestling show run by K1 people. The same idea. You know, they thought they could take over, you know, like MMA people with money. It was popular at the time. They thought they can buy professional wrestling, you know? And, oh, God. And Muto, of all people, went with K1 and did the, you know, Bob Sapp or like Abdul the Butcher against Satake, or you know,
good kind of freak show booking,
or the Ernest Holst doing professional wrestling abdominal stretch,
or you see more of the old, not older, but K1 or sometimes with Hustle, the Pride guys who used to be there, they lost some matches and maybe their career is winding down and then they go to pro wrestling and do some silly stuff.
Yeah, but the pro wrestling is not below something, you know? I mean, that really harmed all the wrestling fans' mind, you know? It's like, they are really, really treating wrestling as something that below some, you know, MMA or boxing or kickboxing or MMA or any shoot sport.
It was treated like a joke.
It's not, and run by people who know nothing at all about wrestling. You know, and we had to really wait, you know, to have rest, you know, like somebody with wrestling heart, wrestling mind, you know, or who will conquer these like a good enough wrestling way, those little things would not matter. You know, you really had to wait until, you know, Hiroshi Tanahashi and Shinsuke Nakamura era. Sort of
coming close to, and around this time, I think 2008 was when Keiji Muto actually had an All Japan match with a young Hiroshi Tanahashi when he visited.
Yeah, yeah.
Tanahashi was kind of the heel, visiting heel.
And Tanahashi was sent to All Japan to participate in Champions Carnival. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
much younger. Yeah.
In return, Muto would, you know, take a couple of dates, New Japan's big shows. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was the extent of what we would see from Keiji Muto. You'd have some the big matches.
another era.
You know, yeah. But yeah, it's just, again, it's like he had great matches with Satoshi Kojima through the time, who Kojima became his own kind of big star in that way. But, and then, so let's talk a little more about Wrestle One. In the initial days, how was the reception to Muto's kind of project with K1?
Well, what's so great about Muto is the he could come in and work Hustle. He could come in and work Wrestle One. He can still work All Japan. What he does is just about the same. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. He does not betray anybody.
He's always Keiji Muto. You know it's him.
Yeah. In any ring, any atmosphere, any environment, or any opponent, Muto will ended up looking like Keiji Muto and always have perfect match. And that saves people's, like, that really saved my day.
It relieves us. Okay. He can make it work.
I think so.
He's kind of like a Terry Funk, where even if the situation is
he's the only
crazy,
one, individual, you know, that the whole group is not like that. I mean, he cannot let everybody else do the same. But when Keiji Muto comes in, we would feel safe, you know, that his match will be okay.
Sure,
know?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, and it started out...
So, all in all, yes, I had, and most wrestling fans, or who, whichever was it, whoever was left at the time, still had faith in Keiji Muto, and he was our guy.
I forgot to mention, around this time, too, especially in the beginning of All Japan, he also took under his wing Kaz Hayashi, who became a big part of All Japan at the time.
Yeah, because those two became friends in Nitro.
Right, because he was working in WCW at the time.
Yeah, Kaz Hayashi himself was part of the Michinoku Pro Wrestling, you know.
Shiryu.
And he left and he to be on his own. Same time Taka Michinoku left,
Michinoku Pro.
Michinoku Pro Wrestling,
WWF.
And they went to Mexico, went to WWE or WCW, and they try to have their own, pursue their own destiny. And Kaz Hayashi and Muto met in WCW, and Muto, brought him over. It's like, well, you're part of this group,
And he stayed part of Wrestle One and the company even after.
All the way to All Japan too, and the second version of Wrestle W1 too.
Very
recently, yes.
So, well,
things are pretty complicated. It's almost hard for us to follow and remember.
Right.
So I'm just hoping that the listeners out there are following what we're saying.
Think so.
And there was a dark age, and somebody said they could hear my it's like that's how I felt, and when I talk about Dark Age, it really hurts, right?
Yeah,
they could hear it.
Yeah, well, I think because this is also a time just in general where pro wrestling around the world, it was there, but it wasn't on fire like it had been in the past. Not like now, and not to say it's on fire now, but it's definitely more popular than it was.
Yeah, they had to wait. Always takes new superstar, though. See, Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels era, good. And Stone Cold, Rock, and Triple H era, good. But you had to wait until John Cena merged to have another era,
there didn't feel like a big shift yet. We still had a lot of old stars, but in WWE, you still had your Undertaker, you still had your Ric Flair, and in New Japan too at the time, we still saw a lot of old faces showing up. Japan. Keiji Muto is one that kind of persevered, and he didn't really have to. He went with the time, he changed with the style, he didn't kind of get left behind like some wrestlers end up getting left behind because they don't want to change. They just keep what they're doing, what they do. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work as well. But Muto,
And with this version of, this is when Muto introduced, Shining Wizard,
That's right.
As a new
in All Japan.
Yeah.
Because, so why did he introduce a new, less flashy move than, say, Moonsault?
Well, it hurt his knees every time he lands a moonsault, that he shouldn't be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
and he cannot really, you know, fly high to do that high drop kick anymore. It was like somebody leaning, picture Hashimoto on his knees.
Ah.
You run into him and give him, you know, big knee to his face at that height.
Mm.
I mean, came up with Shining Wizard. It's more like a motion and running, and it's a whole dance, not the dance, but you know what I'm saying?
Shuffle.
When you do the pose
.
And let people know that Shining Wizard coming, and 1, 2, 3, 4 step or so, like you hit the move, and that to go home, and you educate the fans as new. This is his new finish. And you beat the guy, so it will be the guy, you know, the move that he's going to beat the guy with, you know?
Yeah, and it felt like a more acceptable finish in the MMA time, too.
Yeah, yeah. And also, that tells you how great, we're talking about Muto now, but what's so great about Muto, just as soon as he introduced the new finish, Shining Wizard, very next week, rest of the world is copying it.
So many, even today.
You know what I'm saying? So many people, all the independent wrestlers in America, all the independent wrestlers, not all, but the many independent wrestlers in Japan, just as soon as you saw the video, those are the moves they want to try.
Yeah.
You know? And that's what's so great about Muto. He's the one who created it.
Yeah. And you hear the English announcers saying they don't change the name or anything. It's the Shining Wizard.
Shining Wizard. So yeah, right.
It says a lot about... just one little creation, and it doesn't seem like it's that big of an impact, but hey, listen, we're still talking about it. Wrestlers still use it today. It added to the continuum, it added to pro wrestling. It didn't take away anything in a hard time where it's hard to.
Maybe three or four moves that's in Japanese, you know, Enzigiri became English word. Saito suplex, maybe, right? Fujiwara armbar, Asai moonsault, and that's about it, though.
Yeah, I heard Orihara moonsault. I've heard all.
Spider German.
Spider. Yeah, I've heard lots of different ones. It depends on the company, I suppose.
Yeah.
But
what's popular is, you know, always Fujiwara armbar, the Enzigiri, and Muto's move.
Because I think like you said, he really taught the fans, taught the audience to know what it is. And because when you think about the Shining Wizard, we think about the move, but I always think about the pose he does afterwards.
Right.
Pro Wrestle Love.
Of course. You know, the whole routine.
Like People's Elbow.
You know what? Rock's People's Elbow came from Muto's Driving Elbow.
Really?
Yeah. The Rock, Dwayne Johnson himself, told Funaki about it.
Wow.
And I heard directly from Funaki, Sho Funaki.
Yeah, I could see that.
Where did this, you know, People's Elbow come from? Young Dwayne Johnson, Rocky, he watched Japanese video, and he always regret that he wanted to have a tour, regular tour, either New Japan or Old Japan. The time wasn't that. It was Nitro, that the Monday Night Raw and SmackDown era, that there is no really one individual wrestler touring to Japanese company anymore, right?
Yeah.
He wanted to work either Old Japan or New Japan, just one tour, you know? And Rock never did.
Wow. But I did see a few years ago, he came over and posed with Muto for some pictures. Do you remember that? I think it was maybe for a movie preview.
Ah, right. The Hercules movie.
Yes, yes.
Right.
Muto came out wearing kind of like a bear's
head skin. Right. Oh, that was a costume. That was in movie.
I see, yes.
Right. So those two met. Right. But, you know, professional wrestler part of Dwayne Johnson always wanted to work Japan.
Mm.
The time, he was an era where there was no communications, right? Like WWE never worked with Japanese company, you know? Mm-hmm. And there wasn't the time American wrestlers was a touring Japanese company like Stan Hansen.
It was a different time.
He always wanted to tour Japan, but WWE structure, that wasn't the time. And but that People's Elbow did come from Muto's Driving Elbow.
Yeah, I guess it's basically the same. It just, you stretch it out for a really long time.
He added more, Yeah.
But yeah, it's the same.
Isn't that interesting?
It's very, very interesting. And it shows how deep and severe Muto's influence is on pro wrestling.
Yeah, and then it's almost, it's like a wrestling anthropology.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. And we need to do part four of Keiji Muto. You know what? We could be doing podcasts
just on Keiji Muto.
To Keiji Muto.
Yeah. I feel like I might have to pay him a fee after we're finished with this.
Yeah, yeah, but at least we have to go part four of Keiji Muto.
Part four, so that's the big announcement, I guess, everyone. Part four is coming next time. But but part four, what we'll do is...
Because we got carried away, because there's so much to talk about, so much we can share. The more we talk about, the more we know how great influential he was. I mean, he's not going to walk around and say, you know, he's a big deal. You know, he is a real person, you know, and very open. And he's a superstar though, but doesn't really come off like, right. I mean, like never stuck up and very, you know, very friendly, you know, and he's honest. Yeah. Yeah.
It seems like the most talented, most successful people, at least that I've met in my life, they often have have that personality. And the people that don't, that they're not at the top, they're maybe in the middle, those are usually
very insecure.
Those are the people that you always have problems with, especially when we talk about talent, like wrestling or music or writing.
Yeah, yeah, because they're not totally, confident, mm-mm. You know?
But that's part of what makes Keiji Muto so great. He's so confident in the ring, especially as a character like Great Muta. I mean, you need a lot of confidence to pull off something like...
And it looks like he's having a great time.
It looks like he's having fun. And I don't think any other wrestlers could do that.
Like dancing around, went to blow mist and all mm-hmm. that. Yeah.
Or just rolling in and out of the ring, just being kind of a little eccentric.
Right, right.
It's because he has that confidence.
He is the one who's conducting the audience. He doesn't play to the audience mm-hmm. or beg the audience. Audience are the one who's watching him,
always. He never asks
instead of wrestler playing for the audience. Yeah,
he knows when they'll cheer. It's very clear on his face.
Yeah, and then what's so amazing, he does that very naturally. Hmm. Very naturally.
And it only could have been from the path that he took, his background. I mean, he was wrestling in a really special time in America, in the South, one of like the meccas of pro wrestling in general, and he took some of those crowds, and geez, you didn't see that too often where an American crowd would be going wild for a Japanese superstar. And we did see that quite a bit.
Right, right. I mean, besides the stereotypical, you know, like a total stereotype Japanese character, right?
I think he was the one who really broke that. I mean, he took the stereotypes, but he made it. I mean, if he didn't do anything, if he didn't add any special flavor to the Great Muta character, it could have been just like that. It could have been a flop. But I mean, he's the only one who could do that Great Muta character. He took it. And because he was so individual and so unique, I think a lot of people said, wow, there are so many cool things that wrestlers could do. So what if I did this? What if he did that? What if she did this thing? So I think it opened a lot of people's minds up too. Especially because he was on TV.
He had the size, you know.
And he had the size.
Legitimately big person.
Yeah, he never looked out of
really
place.
Big for Japanese.
He looked like a great counterpart to someone like Sting.
Yeah.
They're about the same size, but Sting had the light blonde hair and the bright makeup, and he had the darker makeup and dark hair. So,
and they worked around the horn, too. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not the TV, but the house shows every night for about 5 months period. Almost every night. And Muto told Sting, start doing moonsault, you know? And Sting said, I had to practice.
But those two, for being as big as they were,
they respected each other. Respected each other so much. Yeah.
So, okay. So then let's cut right here. And next time, we're going to try to finish it. And what I want to focus on, I suppose, we'll focus on Wrestle 1. And we'll focus on...
Which version? First version or second
version? We'll focus on the first version because we only kind of scratched the surface today. But I can tell you about... I was actually at the... He had his 30th anniversary show in 2014.
Okay.
I went to that at Sumo Hall where he faced Masayuki Kono in the finals. But this was...
Okay. Very good. Those are new wrestlers.
Yeah. So this was kind of the time where that version of Wrestle One had been working with TNA, and it was kind of on the out. There was kind of
to make a connection to today's wrestling. Muto's version of All Japan debuted people like Suwama, you know, Sanada, Kai, Bushi? Taichi.
Was Bushi there?
Bushi there too, yes, yes, yes. Bushi, Hiroshi, Yamato, Suwama,
Maybe Kushida too, I believe.
Kushida was trained by Tajiri.
Ah, okay, so he was an outsider, but different school.
A loop. When Kushida was a little kid, he came to Hustle Wrestling School.
Oh my gosh, I'm surprised he's such a good wrestler now.
So talented people, you know, it really never mattered, you know? Yeah. But debuting Sanada and Taichi, Suwama, you know, Kai, all at the same time. So Muto did develop those new era talent.
And he helped train them?
Yeah.
So there's
All Japan, Muto's version of All Japan.
So that's in the DNA of modern wrestling too, is like the people he worked with.
Right, all, right.
Sanada's a big star now. Taichi's a big star now. So his fingerprints.
Suwama is Mr. All Japan.
Triple Crown champion. Yeah. So his fingerprints are everywhere, actually.
Yeah, So it's been 15 years or so.
And not just Japan. Yeah. In America, in the UK, I think like his influence is wide reaching.
The generations of wrestlers who grew up watching, grew up idolizing Muto. Yeah,
I think he was one of the first big Japanese TV wrestling stars, at least in North America. I mean, he had TV. He was on TV a lot, and you don't forget a face like that. I mean, that's pretty memorable, especially if you're a child.
Right. It's a little different era too, you know, because back in 1964, Giant Baba headlined Madison Square Garden against Bruno Sammartino, you know. So those were the different era. So TV, cable TV, satellite, all the technologies, we have to, you know all those things, what was happening in the real world out there to understand Muto, you know.
Big part of it. So we'll come back next week and we'll talk about Wrestle One. Yeah. We'll talk about how he got involved in pro wrestling, Noah, and we'll get up to today.
And this is going to be his maybe final run, but still going strong. Oh my god.
And he has a match this month too with Kaito Kiyomiya.
Yeah.
So by the time we finish, I'm sure that match will happen or it will stay on.
I hope
we can maybe finish and that'll be the day. I don't remember what day that's on, but that'll be coming up soon. So it's Muto month here at Viking Media Patreon. Yeah. So
at least we gotta have another part four. Another episode of Muto.
We'll wrap up.
I couldn't finish it. Sorry about that.
No, it's of course.
I got carried away.
There's so much, and we had to talk through. I think the Dark Ages are really important to talk about, and we'll probably talk about them more.
Oh yeah, and the Dark Age of wrestling, I had to go through my own experience. Oh my gosh, I got a stomach.
We'll have to someday talk about Hustle when you're feeling a little better. I don't want you to keel over while we're recording.
Yeah, but I didn't realize we've been talking this long.
That's okay. It's easy.
Well, let's do it again.
So we'll do it soon. We'll come back next week. I'm Justin on Twitter. I'm Justin M. Nipper, at Justin M. Nipper. Fumi on Twitter and Facebook. Can you give us your credentials?
Yeah. On Twitter, Fumihiko Dayo, FUMIHIKODAYO, Fumihiko Dayo on Twitter. Or you can just find me, Fumi Saito, on Facebook.
All right. So I'm going to let Fumi take it away.
So long from Tokyo, and see you next time.
Write that down.